Thanks to Barry for working on the speaker stand for me. It's not wobbly at all. The bad news is he didn't fix me a bit. And if there's any wobbliness in the lesson, it'll be all my fault today. In Habakkuk chapter 2, we are at the place where an essential thing happens in this process of question and answer that we find out. Habakkuk has said, why do you see the iniquity and why do you look at wrong? And God says, I'm working a work. And then Habakkuk says, how can you look idly at traitors, and how can someone with pure eyes like you look at wrongdoing and use the more cruel and unrighteous one to punish or to bring judgment on others? And God's answer to this one is, the just shall live by faith. And the thing is that eventually, if God is the moral ruler of his world, as he is, and if there is such a thing as justice, and there is, then eventually there has to be an end to this series of whys and what ifs and when, how long. And in Habakkuk chapter 2, there's an illustration from the Lord himself that in his purposes this happens not only in this life, but ultimately with judgment itself. And in this case, we're talking about the Babylonians and what they would do to bring justice to the wrongdoers in Judah and Jerusalem, but then the Babylonians don't get away with their own cruelty and their own injustice and their own unrighteousness because it does its own work on them, and then they answer themselves to reaping what they have sown. In chapter 2, God's answer to Habakkuk's second complaint was to write down a vision. This is chapter 2, verse 2. And a vision is what God is revealing. Write it on the tablets, make it plain so that anyone can read it, and then run. And then verse 3, he makes the point that this vision is... It waits the right time. It waits the appointed time. This is not something which is immediate, but the fact that it waits the appointed time does not mean it won't happen. And I draw a connection here between here and 2 Peter 3 in the New Testament, where some people are saying, it's going on like it is forever. It won't ever change. We've heard God will deal with evil forever, and then we overlook the fact that he has done so regularly within history in different ways at different times. It won't lie, it says. It seems slow. If it seems slow, wait for it, verse 3 says. But then verse 4, what is easily overlooked is that there are two prongs to verse 4. We commented last week on how important verse 4 is in the New Testament. It's in Romans 1:17, Galatians 3:11, and Hebrews chapter 10, verses 36 through 38, or 37 through 39, one or the other. But in that passage, Both in coming to rely on the gospel and then in staying with the gospel, this verse turns out to be important. But there are two prongs to it. It's not just the just shall live by his faith, or the righteous shall live by his faith, but it's also a contrast to the arrogance of the wicked. Look at the first part of verse 4. Behold, this relates to the Babylonians, whom God is going to use as an instrument of judgment. His soul is puffed up. it is not right within him. Puffed up means arrogant or proud, or the idea is that the wicked comes along gaining some victories for himself, and he thinks it will always be, and he'll always be on top, and he'll never have to answer to anyone, and he'll be secure in his pride. And God is about to say, that's not how it works. So what follows in Habakkuk 2 are the five woes of Habakkuk, and only God is speaking them here. It's similar to Isaiah chapter 5. There are six woes in that chapter. Woe, it's not W-H-O-A, the way Gene and I used to say woe. It is woe, W-O-E. And woe is not simply a pronouncement of a curse or a declaration of angry judgment. It is, here's my paraphrase of it. Oh, the sorrow of. This is someone who can look farther down the road than the pride of evil victory at the moment and realize this is leading somewhere, and it's a sad outcome for the arrogant. It's too bad that has to happen in human life or in human experience. So let's look at this series of woe of this. This is how things work out for the proud wicked. All right, I'm going to start in verse 5. I'm reading from the English Standard Version. There are some places where the alternate translation is found that I'm going to call your attention to it. Verse 5 is a difficult one to translate. Moreover, wine is a traitor. The other possibility is that wealth is what's spoken of here. That wealth is a traitor. An arrogant man who is never at rest. And the idea of this is the arrogant person, whether we're talking about wealth or pleasure, wealth or luxury, gets to thinking that that will be fulfillment in his life, and it never works out that way in the long run. It seems so in a moment, but it doesn't work. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Sheol is parallel to Hades in the New Testament. It stands for death or the grave and what happens beyond. And the idea here is similar to Proverbs 30, verses 15 and 16, where death is never satisfied. The grave is never satisfied. It always wants to claim more, and that's the wicked work here. His greed is wide as Sheol. I read of an interview one time with John D. Rockefeller, the original. How much money does it take to make a man happy? You know what he said? He said, a little bit more. If it always takes a little bit more, then it never satisfies, does it? And death is like that. How much does it take to satisfy death? A few people more. And like death, he never has enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects his own all peoples. And that's a description of the conqueror, the Babylonian, the Chaldean, the cruel one that we read about last week. And then here comes the proverbs or the taunts against him. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him? Now, all these people that he has conquered, in other words, take up their taunt against the evil or the wicked conqueror, and with scoffing and riddles for him they say. Here's the first woe. Woe number one in verse 6 and following is woe, or oh, the sorrow of, and notice how long here, the one who heaps up, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long, and loads himself up with pledges. In other words, these are, he I'll put it up here this way. He heaps up what is not his own. What kind of a picture does that bring to you? What's he talking about? And this is in our text here, verses 6 through 8. All right, he confiscates what belongs to other people and claims it. He annexes it. He what's another word for it? He steals it. Even though it's not his, it belongs to others. Woe to him who heaps up what's not his own. And then there's the for how long means this won't last. How long is this going to go on? And loads himself up with pledges. The practice of these ancient kings was they would take what people had, levy a tribute or a tax on them. If they couldn't pay it, then they had to make pledges, debts or promises to pay later on. And then if that was not paid, then he'd wipe them out. And then, will not your debtors suddenly arise, and those who will awake who will make you tremble? Then you'll be spoiled for them. In other words, aren't people going to get tired of this and then rise up against you? It forever happened, and even in Judah and Jerusalem, that they would make a pledge to one of these Assyrian or Babylonian kings, and then there'd be people at work in the land who would say, let's get Egypt or somebody on our side, and let's not pay this anymore. They wouldn't think to turn to the Lord and do it, but they'd do it that way, and then there'd be suffering over that. Because you have plundered many nations, all the remnant of the people shall plunder you. For the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities, and all who dwell in them. If you attach the last part of verse 8 to the middle of verse 6, you notice that this heaping up what is not his own occurs in the form of plundering violently. Notice the blood and the violence to cities and to the earth and to cities who dwell in them. So this is someone, this is either a nation. Can it be done by individuals too? Would this principle be true in individual lives? Yes, of course. So someone who does not care what it takes from other people, he has no regard for other people's life or well-being or property. He just wants what that other one has. And if he can take it, then he will take it. And the principle of verse 6 is, eventually, you reap what you sow in that way. People won't put up with that forever. Somebody will come along. If you're always taking the littler kid's lunch money, then eventually a bigger kid comes along than you. And then what happens? Well, that's the... In God's answering Habakkuk here, and he's... What does this have to do with Habakkuk's doubts and his questions and the challenges to his faith? What God is saying to him is, Habakkuk, you ask me, chapter 1, verse 2, O Lord, how long? And God's answer is, Habakkuk, what the Babylonians are going to do here won't last forever. And if you and I know that it wasn't all that many years to the Medes and the Persians took Babylon without firing a shot, so to speak. And the pride of Babylon was destroyed. So that's the first one. Is this one needed for our time? We've already said it can happen with individuals. Pardon? It's happening right now, isn't it? And the unfortunate thing is, it's not only happening 6,000 miles away, it's happening in some of our cities and localities and so forth as well. This is a human problem. This is inhumanity and injustice at work. And the principle is still needed. At the end of the of our study last week in our assembly, I read a statement that I found somewhere in a commentary about that first thought, judgment does not seem to be compatible with gospel until you realize that if there is not ultimately a judgment of evil, then there is no real hope. And I think that's the point being made here. The second woe starts in verse 9. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. What does that picture bring, that statement bring to your mind? He gets evil gain to make himself secure. So in his arrogance, he gets evil gain, thinking that his evil gain will affirm his arrogance. That's the idea, that he'll be even more beyond any kind of an accounting if he takes what someone has. He weakens those who might attack him or might challenge him. So verse 10, you have devised shame for your house by cutting off many peoples. You have forfeited your life, for the stone will cry out from the wall and the beam from the woodwork respond. The Babylonians would they invaded and took the famous cedars of Lebanon, cut them down and carried them off to Babylon to build king's palaces and so forth with them. They took stone from other countries that they conquered and made the citizens of those countries engage in slave labor in order to make those stones into walls for their like Babylon itself and its famous walls and so forth. And this prophet hears God saying, there's going to come a time when the beams in your palace are going to cry out for judgment, and the walls on your famous hanging gardens or so forth are going to cry out for accounting. And it is what you thought was your security is going to be calling out for your judgment, demanding your judgment. That itself is quite a thought. What would you think how would it have application here? You have forfeited your life in thinking that you were feathering your nest. That's my summary of it. Read history and you'll find out how literally true this came to be for Babylon itself. And you probably can think of illustrations of it and maybe in your own lifetime within historical settings. The sobering thing is still true. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high. The other famous illustration of this would be Mount Seir or Edom, with its, if you've looked up pictures of Petra and noticed how they thought they were secure, and this gets condemned by the minor prophets in and others of the prophets. All right, verse 12 now. I have to go faster than I want to. Verse 12. Woe to him who builds a town with his blood, with blood, and not his blood, but with blood, and founds a city on iniquity. So here's the deal. He builds with blood. And founds with iniquity. And this is, in other words, this is, again, inhumanity or violence or injustice, and then iniquity is simply with ungodliness or wrongdoing. This would be a case where someone is preceded as if the ends justify the means. And there's no scruples, there's no principles, there's no limits. There's only power and success. And again, the way of thinking involved in that kind of thing is sobering in a world which operates so much by simply raw power and wealth, and then ability to do whatever is imagined. So verse 13 now, behold, it is not from the Lord of hosts that people labor merely for fire, is it not from the Lord of hosts that people labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing? Meaning, the way things work out, can't you see that the Lord is allowing this, but that the Lord's ways may be inscrutable or past tracing out, but they're not deniable, because here's what happens, and then it doesn't last for long. Now, verse 14 is one of the two great theological principles that happen in this chapter. The other one's in verse 20. John led us in singing it last Sunday. Verse 14 is, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters that cover the sea. As the waters cover the sea. How well do the waters cover the sea? Pretty effectively, right? In other words, completely. Sometimes in my own prayers, when I can't think of how else to say it, when I'm praying the parallel to your kingdom come, your will be done, I just pray for the success of God's kingdom in this world, and that his glory, his will, might cover the whole earth. God's kingdom might cover the whole earth as waters that cover the sea. In this passage, there are two places in the Old Testament that illustrate this. One is when God is getting the victory over Pharaoh and the armies of Egypt in Exodus 14. I'll get glory over him. The Egyptians will have to recognize that I'm Lord. Everybody will. And another case of this happens in the book of Numbers. I can't remember the chapter, unfortunately. The same idea as this comes up. I think this is a thing that we need to bear in mind. This is how things work out eventually. This is the success of God's kingdom, and this is the ultimate goal of things. Most famous statement of this is in Isaiah 11 and verse 9, if you want to go look there. And of course, that has to do with the work of the Messiah, the outcome of the work of the Messiah. Verse 15 now, woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You think about this one for a moment. And I noticed that there are, in the translations, there are two ways in which this gets taken. One is where you you aim for sensual or sexual conquest of some sort, which uses people and destroys people and so forth. The other way this gets taken, and the direction that I sort of go with it, is it looks to me like that what's in view here is total humiliation of another human being, where someone is he loses control of himself, and this is with the drink part of it, and then he loses any kind of dignity. This is the gazing at their nakedness, where they're simply made objects and made fun of and so forth, or humiliated, and then they are shamed. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand, the cup is judgment here, wrath. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. You're humiliating other people, so you're going to get something instead of glory yourself. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them. Some believe it means here that not only did the Babylonians rob the forests of Lebanon, but also even destroyed the lives of the animals. For the blood of man and the violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Notice again the idea of the inhumanity. So here is you make drunk in order to gaze at. So I'm going to just shorthand it and say you humiliate and use or shame people. You engage in, and a good way to say it is you simply engage in total inhumanity. People are treated as if they are things or objects whose lives have absolutely no meaning, and you use them for sport, you use them for self-satisfaction, you use them as if... your fun was more value than their lives. And then the fifth one is the woe to those who make and serve idols, who trust in idols, I'll put it that way here, who trust in their own gods. And this is a particularly vivid statement here that he makes. Look at it. He starts this time not with the woe, but with the outcome of it. What profit is an idol when its maker has shaped it? A metal image, a teacher of lies. What if it's made out of metal, can it teach you? Can't teach anything. For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. You make an idol, an object who can't say anything, therefore he can't teach anything. You made it yourself and you trust in it. We like to excuse ourselves that we don't make any totem poles, or we don't set up any idols and call them gods and so forth. But we do certainly worship the works of our own hands quite a bit, and whether they're call phones or TVs or houses or cars or whatever else, it still would be the case. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, "Awake! to a silent stone, arise. That's what it is to pray to an idol, by the way. What you're doing is asking a wooden thing to help you and a silent stone to get up. It's not going to happen. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there's no breath in it at all. It has no life in it. It can't teach. It can't speak. It can't move. It can't get up. It's overlaid with gold and silver, and it won't help. Now, verse 20 comes, the second of the great truths of this chapter. Behold, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Please notice the contrast that's drawn there. It's easily skipped over, I think. Here are people hollering out to a wooden thing, awake, or a stone, arise. It's not moving at all. Here's the living God who can teach, move, do, saying to people, be silent before him. And in this case, we like to use this song to start an assembly or something. In this chapter, however, it is a statement of God's place of judgment as judge. And what it's saying is, in answer to Habakkuk's questions and complaints, and in answer to the Babylonians' inhumanity and evil, the Lord's in his holy temple. Let the earth keep silence before him. And I want to ask you now, to, before we go, look at verse 14 and verse 20 together, and think of how these two statements serve to drive home the point made in this chapter and the questions that Habakkuk has about why God's letting the things go on that he does. Why do they get away with it? How can power and cruelty and evil have its way like it does? How can someone take what's not his own, get evil gain, and look like he's so strong nothing will ever happen? Build his whole empire on blood and iniquity, humiliate, use, shame, destroy people, and devote himself to idols. Look at verse 14 and 20 and just read these two together, and let me do that, and we'll close our class this way. And I think this might make the point. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord that as waters that cover the sea. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. You think about that. Does it take faith? Remember, this started, the just or the righteous shall live by his faith. Does it take faith to believe verse 14 and 20 in a world like it is? Absolutely. I want to just point out to you that part of faith is believing there will be an end, that these types of approaches will result in sorrow. It's one thing to say, I have faith that there is a God and that God is good and that his will be done. But part of faith is believing that the outcome of these ways of life will be sorrow. And part of faith is believing that the world works like these two verses say, and not like the approaches that are described here. It's hard to maintain faith in the world because this kind of faith in the world works like this because we live in limited sections here where the how long may be our whole lives. And there's the challenge to this that Habakkuk meets. We'll need the prayer of chapter 3. Chapter 3 is overwhelming a bit because so many of the phrases are not familiar to us. We have to, the places, you have to look them up and think about it. But we need this prayer, though. We're going to look at it next Lord's Day, Lord willing. So spend some time reading through and investigating chapter 3. Appreciate you being with us today.